tell they got a lot to eat. It's good news.
It's KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, 5 o'clock here on the campus of University of California, Irvine. Coming up, Subversity with Dan Zhang. Today we bring you the talk given by Ralph Nader of the Green Party on Friday, last Friday, at Chapman University. This is Subversity, the public affairs show that penetrates the orange curtain, smashes conventional norms, and transgresses more and more boundaries each week here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Orange County.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
This is Subversity here with Dan Zhang. We're going to bring you the talk given by Ralph Nader, and we're going to go to him right away, right now. This is Ralph Nader. It's a cheering crowd at Chapman University.
Thank you for that great welcome. And why shouldn't you welcome us? Because we are the new progressive political party of Young America. You just heard from Medea Benjamin, wasn't she something? Well, we've been campaigning all over the country, all 50 states, from Hawaii to Maine and Alaska to Florida, and many states more than once, and are drawing the largest political rallies of all presidential candidates, filling Madison Square Garden. Republican. with the same craven, myopic, greedy corporate interests. And they're very successful. They're raising every 2 years, almost by geometric progression, more and more money from the same special interests who go to the same dinners held by the Republicans and the Democrats. It's now right two checks. One from the pharmaceutical industry to the Republicans, one to the Democrats. One from the auto dealers, lobby, one to the Democrats. One after another, that's the way it is. And what does that do after a while? It turns the U.S. Senate incumbent into a money machine. Here in California, U.S. senators, when they're running for re-election, they don't meet with people anymore, except for a quick few photo opportunities. They're just too busy raising money. They've got to raise $20, $25, $30 million just for a Senate run, if it's reasonably competitive between the two parties. But it's important to recognize that every move forward to social justice is marked by a shift of power from the few to the many. That's the cardinal theme. Every movement. Just look at our own country. The revolution in 1776. If the pollsters were there then, here's how it would break down among the colonists. One third were for getting the exit sign pinned on King George III. They were for the revolt. One third were Tories, and one third were people who had no comment. You see? Even something is what we read about so enthusiastically as establishing the United States of America was not backed by majority opinion. But you know who prevailed, of course. And when they went to that hot room in Philadelphia in 1787 to work on the Constitution, there were about 90 people who went there. And as far as I can determine, not one of them was an expert in stagecoach design and repair. The predecessors of computer programs. They were steeped in political philosophy, comparative government, jurisprudence, the lessons of history, countervailing powers, checks and balances. That's what they were steeped in. They were steeped in practical politics in those days too. And when you think of how you want to spend your time as a student, I suggest that you don't overdo the trade school aspects of your education. Lots of students come to schools, especially the big universities, just looking to get some skills, accounting, computer programming, business administration, marketing, to get a job. To whom I reply, you're wasting your time. You can get it faster by going to a trade school. Go to university just for that. You go to university to learn how to become a skilled, effective citizen, building a democracy. Learn how to build a deliberative democracy, how to develop a thirst for learning after finishing formal education. And as a result, that will get you into the humanities and into the social sciences. You know, this is an aside. I can always tell by the body language of the student what the student's majoring in. The student comes on and says, what are you majoring in? The student goes, computer science. Another student comes up and says, what are you majoring in? Come on, tell me. Well, English literature. I know it can be a job. I kind of like that reading Shakespeare. Now let's run through the lessons of history very briefly. The drive to abolish slavery, that took away power from the big cotton plantations and said to them, you're no longer going to emancipation came to millions of African Americans and some First Natives shifted power. The women's suffrage movement. It wasn't just men that didn't allow women the right to vote. When those six women met in that farmhouse in Seneca Falls in 1846 to start it all, it was the business establishment. Didn't like their fight against child labor. Women were mobilizing against the hard edges of the Industrial Revolution. The liquor interest didn't allow women to vote either. And when the women finally got to vote by constitutional amendment, early part of the 20th century, they shifted power. When the workers, their brutalized conditions deep in the coal mines and in the auto and steel and other industries, decided to form trade unions, get laws that allowed them to do so, starting with the Knights of Labor in the late 19th century, that was a shift of power. Shift of power from the giant steel, auto, coal, other companies. They have to shift some power to do so. And it ran through the farmer, progressive populist movement, which you don't read enough about. It started in East Texas in 1887 against the big banks and railroads whose practices were squeezing the livelihoods of those farmers, no matter how hard they worked. High interest rates, high freight rates, they decided enough is enough. In 6 months, they organized 200,000 farmers in six Texas counties in East Texas. $1 each, those are the dues, like $45 now. And they roared out of the East Texas area and spread the populist movement all over the United States in the following 25 years, electing senators, governors, legislators at the state level, almost the president, and they changed the political landscape quite fundamentally for us, which we're still benefiting from. Shift of power from the dominant business community to the farmers. They developed their own cooperatives, their own production facilities, improved their bargaining power, preserved the small farm, preserved rural America, which is now under serious distress, probably the most serious crisis ever, because of the crushing power when the power shifted back to the agribusiness giants like Cargill, ADM, IBP, the beef giant, the hog farm conglomerates, the giant chicken processes that are moving our entire farm economy to factory farming, industrialized agriculture, and contract agriculture, which reduces our farmers to peons and serfs and completely decays rural life in America, without which America would not be America. That's what happens when power shifts back to these giant corporations. In our century, 20th century, look at the same thing. What the environmental movement do? It says to giant polluters and others, you are not going to have an unfettered right to pollute and to fill our lives and our bodies with toxic and other material that represent a silent form of cumulative violence. You're going to have to share your decision with public, enforceable environmental standards, whether it's for pesticides or for motor vehicle emissions or any other form of environmental adversity. None of this was, you know, very substantial. I'm just trying to point out that whatever successes we had is because of shift of power. And it's interesting that whether it's the civil rights movement or women's rights more recently, gay, lesbian rights, and disability rights, all of these movements have that common theme of giving people more power. And you see people sitting in wheelchairs now, rolling down the street merrily. They have access because they've got these curbs. They don't have to fly over anymore. They have more occupational access for jobs. It's a wonderful thing. The other day, Washington, D.C., I saw five wheelchair riders have a race with one another. I was very concerned. They were really speeding along. On the subway, they're having a great time. That didn't happen by accident. That happened because they took the power. They sat in buildings and protests and demanded legislation and got the Americans with Disability Act and other statutes before that. Where are we now? Well, I think we must recognize almost every social justice movement in America was opposed by a dominant business community of that period. Everyone. What does that do? these injuries with the most bizarre way the car's vehicles crumbled. You would see the steering column after a crash, the steering column way back in the driver's seat and up toward the road. You can't survive that as a driver. You see the doors popping open and the occupants right onto the hard pavement. How much higher risk of death when you're ejected like that. You see people with their skulls chopped open by all these things that were on dash panels in the 50s and 60s, cutting edges. People thrown through windshields, children thrown through windshields. There were no seat belts, padded dash panels, there were no collapsible steering columns, no head restraints, no strong door latches, no side impact protection, no airbags. And I started saying to myself, I wrote a paper on this in law school, the third year. I started saying to myself, what's wrong with these guys in Detroit? They got great engineers and scientists. They've been telling us for years that they can do all of these things. They just got to get the go signal from executive suite. And these executives riding around in limousines and making huge money and benefits and perks, they just didn't care. Even when the pathologists had presentations in rooms with slides, and they would show what would happen when the rearview mirror was not breakaway. How could split open the skull in a 15-mile-an-hour collision? That just like water off a duck's back. That got me very angry. You know what happens when people get angry and they're informed? They get motivated.
You're listening to KUCI Subversity Program. We're broadcasting Ralph Nader's talk from last Friday at Chapman University.
And I didn't go to a corporate law firm like I could have coming out of Harvard Law School. I went after General Motors. People said, General Motors is the biggest corporation in the world. Well, I said, the bigger they are, the harder they're going to fall.
This is KUCI 88.9 FM.
Record economic growth. 47 million workers, one out of every this country. And look, if you can only look how well they are. There are 10 million workers, 70% of adults are making $5.15 an hour around the country. Federal minimum wage. I know it's a little higher in California, the state. But that is $2.15 less than what the minimum wage was in 1968, adjusted for inflation. And the economy has doubled in real terms, output per capita. The minimum wage should be doubled in real terms what it was in 1968. A few months ago, I met a woman on the campaign trail. She's a mother, a simple child, 45 years old. Where do you work? She says, Walmart. How do you get there? She said, I had to buy a used car and travel 8 miles every day to get the job. What do you mean pay? $6.60 an hour. This is a company that's dropping its profits, that pays its executives millions of dollars a year, whose stock has been booming. See the greed? There's one thing you got to remember about commercial power. It was taught to us by every major religion in the world. When it gets too much power, it has no boundaries and no restraints other than that imposed on it from the outside. Remember, the business community had slaves in our country. The business community now is contracting with companies abroad that have virtual slaves and brutalized child labor working at the factories and other places of employment. And it doesn't phase them. Remember, these are now corporations that want to patent your genes, that want to patent the life forms, that want to transform the genetic inheritance of the planet into 17-year monopoly patents. They want to basically control the very genetic feedstock of our plants, our animals, and human beings. These are corporations who know no boundaries in courting and siding with dictatorships, as long as they get lucrative contracts from these dictatorships that brutalize their people. These are corporations who, to this day, are indifferent to the fate of the environmental situation on our planet. They are suppressing solar energy, even buying up the companies in order to suppress it, to expand their fossil fuel and their nuclear power business. These are corporations who, in so many ways, are willing to spread cancer around the world, like the tobacco industry. What is its marketing plan now that it's been curbed a little bit in the United States? And smoking rates have dropped from 44% to about 26% in the United States since 1964, one of the great consumer protection victories in our generation. What are they doing? What are they doing? Here's what they're doing. They're moving on all fronts to hook tens of millions of youngsters in Africa, Asia, and South America into a lifetime of smoking from home, from which one out of three are going to die. You say, Philip Morris, what do? They generate cancer and other tobacco-related diseases. They know it. They finally admitted it. They finally admitted that tobacco use is not by carrots or celery. These are corporations who are willing to sell weapons, lethal and otherwise, landmines, napalm, jet planes, tanks, to anyone who will buy them around the world. You know, they used to call them merchants of death in the 1930s, 1920s. They know no nationality. They know no loyalty to country or community other than to control them. That's what they know, just to control them. It doesn't matter who is the buyer. As long as the buyer can pay for these deadly weapons, they will sell. The only difference between now and 50, 60 years ago is that we are subsidizing these exports of weapons by private corporations like Lockheed Martin and General Dynamics and Northrop and others, with our tax dollars. And the latest estimate by Senator Hatfield, before he retired, $67 billion, with a B, dollars a year. Our tax dollars are funding these exports of lethal weapons. Well, why do they sell landmines? Because our Clinton-Gore administration still refuses to sign the international landmines treaty. These are companies who know no boundaries, and why should we expect it? They are driven by a singular motivation. whatever it is. And that's why politics was in part invented, you know. It's counteract what Thomas Jefferson called the money interest excesses, the excesses of the money interest. That's what he said a representative government should be for. And now, the corporations have taken over our government. They dominate it. So many people say that, it's almost no way we have to give documentation. I mean, I could read you Senator John McCain, Senator Russ Feingold, Senator Paul Wellstone, all of these are basically saying the same thing. They're saying that the politics and elections in our country has been a scam, where politicians, in order to get elected, raise money from largely business interests, and then in turn, sell the government to them. So when people say, now the Republicans different from the Democrats, and aren't the Democrats different than the Republicans, I'm so amused by that. Because they don't matter anymore.
Might be. But in terms of the fundamental structure,
in terms of the fundamental structure of power, the displacement of a government that's supposed to be of, by, and for the people, to a government of, by, and for big business. The only difference between Al Gore and George W. Bush is the velocity with which their knees hit the floor when corporations got on.
So that was Ralph Nader, first part of his talk at Chapman University last Friday. You're listening to Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and webcast at kuci.org. This is Dan Zhang. We're going to come back with the second portion of his talk at Chapman University last Friday as he tries to get people to vote for him as the standard bearer of the Green Party. And on Subversity, we have heard in the past, or on alternative news here on KUCI, we've heard earlier this hour, the previous hour, Medea Benjamin, who's running for Senate from the Green Party, as well as Winona LaDuke, which we aired her talk before the American Library Association this summer in July. When she talked at a panel on alternative media. This is Dan Zhang with Subversity.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Not necessarily a reflect, I suppose. I would think. This is Dan Zhang. Back to Subversity. We're going to continue with our broadcast of the talk that was given by Ralph Nader, the Green Party candidate for president at Chapman University in the city of Orange in California here. And here Nader is talking about G.W. Bush. Is Nader.
Passionate conservative. He objected to a public defender system proposal that would have allowed some competent counsel to defend accused of capital crimes that he is sending to the death chamber in such numbers. Now, he's a compassionate conservative. Yes, indeed. He proudly says that he helped pass a law in Texas that made it harder for wrongfully injured Texans from having their full day in court against the perpetrators of their harm under our tort system, under our civil justice system. I wonder what he'd be like if he wasn't a compassionate person. His sign when he speaks is "Leave no child behind." That's all about his diet. Leave children behind. Should be leave no corporate dollars behind. But now comes the great imposter and the great pretender, Al Gore. I've known him for so many years. Al Gore says he's an environmentalist. Let's see. Go into Eastern Ohio and ask the people in East Liverpool, Ohio, when he was campaigning there with Bill Clinton in 1992, they both were appalled at this giant new incinerator project that was supposed to be built in a floodplain. And Al Gore said, "Elect us, and it won't be built." Well, he and Clinton were elected, and it was built. And within a year, the mercury content in the urine of the children in the school that was 1,100 feet from this giant incinerator doubled. And ever since then, he's refused to respond to the pleas of that white community in that part of Ohio. I noticed recently that that's not part of his campaign schedule. Then go to the motor vehicle industry. In his book, 1992, he said the motor vehicle internal combustion engine is a threat to the global climate. What did he and Clinton do? First, years of free ride with no proposed fuel efficiency standards. That means more out of your pocketbook because your vehicles are not as fuel efficient, and more pollution in the air, and more greenhouse gases. Indeed, although they promised us 40 miles per gallon by the year 2000, it's now 24.5 miles per gallon and sinking, the lowest since 1980 average fuel economy for motor vehicles produced this past year. Nuclear power, he loves it. As a matter of fact, he's just said to the World of Nations that he wants our nuclear power plants as credits under the Kyoto Treaty, because they don't produce greenhouse gases. They just produce deadly radioactive waste that he doesn't know where to put for the next 200,000 years. Pesticide policy, very weak once he even held down his own EPA. The biotechnology, gung-ho, free ride. His administration never saw a bioengineered seed they didn't approve. 100% approval. You think he's holding your feet to the scientific fire? You think he's saying that the biotech industry's technology is way ahead of the science, which has to be its governing discipline, that there are major scientific questions that they do not answer, and that they're increasing the risk of some terrible out-of-control sequence here? No. He just goes and collects money from them. WTO, NAFTA, anti-environmental to the core. They subordinate environmental as well as worker and consumer standards to the imperatives of international commerce in a closed-door autocratic system of governance. He hasn't even read the agreements. One is 800 pages, the other is 500 pages. WTO, NAFTA. He just worked off memos. There's only one presidential candidate who's read those agreements, and you're looking at them.
Tom DeLay, Dick Armey, and
Treadlock about as craven and avaricious a lot as ever crawled up to Capitol Hill. What?
Assemblyman from New York, Albany, had visited him with an insurance executive.
insurance executive was a very good guy, actually. He wanted to protect mutual policyholders' assets when these big mutual companies were converted to stock companies so that the executives could get more pay. So they come down to his office and they sit and they make their plea that the mutual policyholders of Metropolitan, John Hancock, Prudential, etc., need to be protected. And he listens. And they leave and they go back to New York. Next day, the insurance executive gets a call. His judge was fundraising. And he said, almost exactly, the senator enjoyed meeting you and the assemblyman, Granis, very much. Listen to you, take your views under consideration. Will you hold a fundraising dinner for the senator? The executive is not the kind who suffers fools gladly. And so he said, what did you say? He said, the senator would like you to hold a fundraising dinner for him. And the executive said, you know, I didn't quite expect that was why he gave me the opportunity to come down to Washington and advise him. That wasn't what I had in mind. And the voice comes over the phone. You mean you won't hold a fundraising dinner for the senator? You know what it is? It's a double game. The corporations shake the bribe the politicians for present and future favors. And the politicians shake down extortion by these corporate lobbyists. That's what's going on. And they made it all legal. See, because they're the law. Well, you know, I don't care how many differences you may think there be between these two parties. If they're alike in the following ways, they must be displaced. If they corrupt, buy and rent our democracy, hijack our government, and turn it over to these corporate interests, and if they keep making sure that we are weaker and weaker as voters, workers, consumers, and taxpayers, those are the two flunk-ups. Those are two sufficient reasons that we have to build a progressive political party on our country, in our country, and a progressive political movement.
You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, Subversity Show.
What that entails is one universal accessible health insurance for everybody with an interest in health. Western Europe gave it, and Canada gave it to their people in the 50s and 60s. 2018, still don't have it. 46 million people without it, 10 million more than when Clinton Gore took office. Number two, we need to repeal the notorious Taft-Hartley Act of 1947, which is a chokehold on tens of millions of low-paid American workers who cannot overcome the tremendous obstructions to forming trade unions in order to lift their standard of living and their conditions. Called a social wage, regardless of whether you're unionized or not. In Western Europe, the people have the following rights. One, 1 month paid vacation, full paid maternity leave, full paid sick leave, adequate public transit to get to work if you don't happen to have a car and want to sit, covered public transit. Got this in the 50s and 60s. What's our excuse? We've allowed too much power to be taken from us, put in the hands of the few, once again. We want to take the hundreds of billions of dollars that are now wasted of our tax money in corporate welfare boondoggles like subsidies, handouts, giveaways, bailouts, all these corporations have got their hand out in Washington, and put that money back into the neighborhoods and communities for affordable housing, repair of our schools, repair of our community health clinics and enlarging them, establishing community development credit unions, and repairing our public works, like our drinking water system. just one itty-bitty bit of corporate welfare billions and slicing off part of that for a national program and for the endowment of the arts. corporate welfare as we know it. We have to have a military budget that's driven by national defense considerations, not by Boeing or Lockheed Martin or Raytheon or the American generals who don't go to work for these industries are speaking out. They're saying, look, these are gold-plated hundreds of billions of dollars worth of new weapon systems for who? Against who? There's no longer a Soviet Union, folks. It's over. The Cold War was pronounced over by George Bush when he was president. The companies are pouring into China, trying to move from criminal capitalism into criminal communism into criminal capitalism. Who's the major enemy? Inner Mongolia, Latvia, Ukraine, Belarus, Russia? And yet, what is Bush and Gore arguing about? How much more they're going to add to the military budget, which is now $320 billion, the highest it's been since the height of the peak of the Cold War. Why are we spending $70 billion a year in upfront backup costs to keep 55 years after World War II, our troops in Western Europe and East Asia defending prosperous allies that are perfectly capable of defending themselves against non-existent enemies?
You're listening to Ralph Nader's talk at Chapman last Friday. This is Subversity. You've been listening to a broadcast of a talk given by Ralph Nader at Chapman University on Friday last week. And preceding that, on Alternative News, you heard a talk given right before that by Medea Benjamin, who's also the Green Party candidate and for the Senate. And Nader, of course, is running for president. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You've been listening to Subversity. The opinions expressed on the show were not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI.
I'm